From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Hollywood is many things, but this summer, original is not one of them.
Oh, it's good to be back.
We've seen Iron Man 2 and Sex and the City 2, both sequels of movies already based on a comic and a TV show. There was The A-Team, also based on a TV show, Eclipse, the latest film from the Twilight book series, and then there's Predators, a sequel to a sequel, and that's assuming you don't count the Predators' side projects with Aliens. To be fair, a highlight of the summer is Toy Story 3.
New toys!
A very good sequel, but no surprises. What was surprising was the performance of one movie last weekend that wasn't based on anything other than a very good idea.
There's one thing you should know about me. I specialize in a very specific type of security. Subconscious security.
Inception made more than $60 million. Coupled with the runaway success of Avatar last year, we wondered, is Hollywood getting back in the business of original ideas? To help us answer that question, I'm joined by Bill Mechanic, the former chairman and CEO of 20th Century Fox Filmed Entertainment. During his tenure, Fox produced some very big and unoriginal films, including Titanic and X-Men, but also The Full Monty and Boys Don't Cry. Mr. Mechanic, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're glad you're here. First things first, what do you think? One or two films, does this make a trend?
No. I think it'll take more failures to get the business off of this current trend of the last few years of copies of copies.
Help us understand what happens in one of these meetings where films are green-lighted. When someone brings in a script that sounds wonderful, it titillates the mind, you can see it, you can feel it, you understand who might star in it, but it's an original idea, doesn't follow a beaten path. What kind of reception does it get?
Well, it's really prior to the green light. Usually when you're starting development, you start with if somebody brings in an idea or a piece of talent pitches an idea, then the doubts start to seed in of, well, who's the audience? When it doesn't have a easy hook to it, or it's like Inception, which is hard to describe what it is, then it will take a superior piece of talent like a Chris Nolan to get that picture put through.
And Chris Nolan, of course, is the director of that film, probably right. Helped also by the star Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, I think in the case of Chris Nolan after The Dark Knight, probably could have done anything with anybody. And in fact, stars like Leonardo DiCaprio and the others, you know, a lot of really talented people in the picture want to work with him. But I think Warner's in that case probably would have made the picture without a big star.
You know, in many ways, Hollywood feels like a parallel universe. It's almost like visiting outer space without leaving the galaxy. But in terms of the business model, it really is wholly different. I mean, most businesses are constantly on the lookout for something new, something fresh, something original, not Hollywood.
Well, let me argue that. I think most businesses... The thing that I always thought was unique about Hollywood or about the movie business is that if you do iPad, something like that, your Apple, you create one new product every few years. Once you have iPad, all you're doing is making improvements to the iPad, but you're making essentially the iPad for the next 4 or 5 years. When you're making a movie, you're making a new movie every week, and they all have to be different. So the fact that Inception works doesn't help whatever the next movie is that Warner has on the release schedule.
You know, I appreciate you speaking with candor about your own experiences. You ended up leaving Fox in part because you championed a film based on a book that seemed at the time a risky choice, not to mention a choice that was somewhat controversial. I'm talking about the film Fight Club, which has turned into a huge cult hit, still quite popular, though it didn't initially do really well at the box office. Do you remember a conversation at the time with the people that you had to answer to in which you had to defend your decision to make that movie?
No, I had to fight to get it made. But that was true of a lot of pictures. You know, Braveheart was basically had to almost resign to get made. Same thing with Fight Club. So
you were willing to walk away from the studio in order to get that made.
Yeah, I mean, I think running a studio, I've always equated it to managing a sports team. You know, if you're in some ways you're hired to be fired, So better to be fired with some dignity and be fired for things that you believe in than fired for making copies of copies.
To go down with honor if you have to.
That's okay. It's not the worst way to go down. You go down anyways.
Bill Mechanic, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Bill Mechanic. He's the former chairman and CEO of 20th Century Fox Filmed Entertainment.
National Book Award finalist Allegra Goodman has often been celebrated by reviewers as a contemporary counterpart to Jane Austen. In novels like Intuition, Paradise Park, and Catterskill Falls, that comparison has been made because of Goodman's astute attention to manners and characters. But now in her new novel, The Cookbook Collector, Goodman makes her debt to Austen explicit by transporting Sense and Sensibility to the Silicon Valley of the 1990s. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says there's more going on here than mere imitation.
There's a luscious party scene about two-thirds of the way through The Cookbook Collector, in which a group of youngish, very clever people gather in an exquisite mansion in Northern California. Champagne and strawberries are served, and the afternoon light turns golden as the day wanes. That scene, for me, captures the overall mood and appeal of Allegra Goodman's new novel. It's shimmering and astute and a little melancholy. In short, it's a midsummer's dream of a novel. There's even a nearby enchanted forest thrown in. In this case, filled with giant California redwoods rather than Arden's ferns and fairies. The Cookbook Collector is about all kinds of appetites for love and sex and God and money and, of course, food. The story revolves around two sisters, Jess, a beautiful 23-year-old graduate student in philosophy, hops impulsively from passion to passion. In contrast, we're told that Jess's older sister, Emily, is possessed of a serene rationality. At only 28, Emily is the multimillionaire CEO of a dot-com startup. If that flighty sister versus level-headed sister premise sounds familiar, it should. Goodman herself has called her latest novel A Sense and Sensibility for the Digital Age. I confess, if anyone other than Allegra Goodman had made that claim, I very likely would have tossed my review copy away. I am very weary of the literary fad of contemporary authors shoplifting plots and characters from the 19th century fiction warehouse. Poor Jane Austen, in particular, has been plucked clean. If you don't know what I'm talking about, check out your local bookstore where you'll find the latest violations, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters. Is there no shame? But Goodman, as she always does, makes a believer out of this skeptic. Goodman says of one of her characters, a brilliant computer programmer, that he had an acquisitive intelligence, and when he appropriated an idea, he improved it until his own version obliterated its source. Of course, I wouldn't go that insanely far in praising Goodman's update of Austen, but I will say that this homage quickly comes to have a glorious life of its own. Jess, the faint reincarnation of impulsive Marianne Dashwood, bicycles around the Berkeley of the 1990s when the novel is set, flitting from philosophy to veganism to tree saving. When Jess begins working part-time at a used and rare bookstore called Yorick's, run by a wealthy, single, middle-aged man called George, we Austen-savvy readers anticipate that wedding bells may eventually ring. But not before fresh complications ensue, especially since Jess is already involved with a charismatic, radical environmentalist. Here's George musing resentfully at the sight of Jess and her hipster boyfriend. Why was it, George asked himself, that the youngest, most innocent-looking women consorted with the creepiest men? Their boyfriends were not boys or friends at all, but shadowy familiars, bears, wolfhounds, panthers. George himself has buried his own animal appetites in books, although Jess's entry into his life and the incursion of the internet into the book trade is making George rethink his monastic ways and the all-too-rare pleasures of reuniting a customer with a long-sought-after copy of, say, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Goodman's nimble language, usually displayed in her characters' sharp readings of one another, is one of the great pleasures of her writing. The other is her ability to integrate serious metaphysical questions into her entertaining comedies of manners. The way in which The Cookbook Collector ultimately veers off from a mere riff on Sense and Sensibility raises crucial doubts about the value of a well-ordered life, as well as the existence of a benevolent God. In Austen's original, Eleanor, the practical one, was rewarded for having 2 feet on the ground. That was the late Enlightenment talking through Austen. But here, in Goodman, modernity pulls the rug out from under Emily's feet.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Cookbook Collector by Allegra Goodman. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. From tractor-trailer tag-along to a top-notch candidate for law school, our next guest has a remarkable academic success story. Carrie Anderson spent her middle and high school years riding in the cab of a big rig with her truck driver mother. She was homeschooled on the road, and eventually she went to a Florida community college. So Anderson was floored back in 2007 when a recruiter from Harvard University came calling and offered a full ride if she'd like to transfer. We read this morning in the Orlando Sentinel of her recent Harvard graduation, and Carrie Anderson joins us now. Congratulations, and I'd like you to pick up the story from there.
Thank you. Actually, I was graduating from Valencia. I wasn't sure where I was going to go next, and I got this email, and they said that they were very interested, and they wanted for me to transfer, and I couldn't believe it. I had to research it first because I thought it might have been some kind of scam or something, but it was real. It was legitimate, and I transferred the next spring.
So I'm trying to imagine when you are new to Harvard and everyone sits around and talks about their experiences, where they're from, where they went to school, and then you start describing your life on the road, in the big rig, being homeschooled by your truck driver mother. Tell us what that was like.
The students' eyes got wide, but also the professors. It's not a story they hear very often at Harvard. There are very few transfer students, and the ones that there were, they were from places like Berkeley and Stanford and places like that. So Valencia Community College alone was very unusual, and then add in the homeschooling and the truck driving experience, and I was a very unique case.
You and your brother, were you both homeschooled?
Yes. He's 2 years younger than I. My mom took us both out of school and homeschooled us both.
So when did you actually hold classes? How did you actually complete your schooling while you were traveling from one state to the other?
A lot of our schooling actually was integrated into what she was doing. When we knew where we were going, Texas to California, for instance, we had to map out the mileage. We had to map out when we had to fuel, how fast we were going to be going, where we needed to stop, rest areas, all of that kind of thing, what our fuel mileage was going to be. That's how she got us going on a lot of it. And then there was a program that we mailed things in. So we did it at our leisure, basically.
So you did it right there in the cab of the truck?
Yes.
And was your mother someone who had a teaching background? This sounds like it was a bit of an adventure for her, too.
It absolutely was. She did not have an education background, but she knew that she wanted us to do very well academically, and so she took it upon herself to make sure we did.
So when you actually transferred first to Valencia Community College and then later on to Harvard, it must have been almost boring to sit in a classroom.
It was a different experience. I had to learn how to study in that atmosphere again and the deadlines and things like that. But I got very involved in extracurricular activities at Valencia, Phi Theta Kappa and student government and things like that. And so that kind of kept my attention.
So what do you miss most about the classroom on the road, the rolling classroom?
Actually, I just went back on the road with her for about a week right after I came home. And I think the thing I miss the most is the total culture. It's a different culture. You meet different kinds of people and you get to see different kinds of, you hear different stories and things like that, and I miss that. It's a different thing you don't get sitting in a classroom.
Hmm. Mom must have been pretty proud of you when you graduated from Harvard.
Slightly, yes.
Slightly? Is that an understatement, I guess?
Yes, she was very proud of herself. She only cried once.
What's next?
I'm studying for the LSAT now, and I'm headed to law school after that.
Carrie Anderson, good to talk to you.
You too. Thank you.
That's Carrie Anderson. She's a 2010 Harvard grad and still the proud daughter of a truck driver.
The iPad may be Apple's newest offering, but when the company announced quarterly earnings yesterday, one of the stars of the show wasn't just the company's hot new tablet computer. It was an old stalwart. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Apple's income rose 78% over last year at this time to $3.25 billion. The company sold over 3 million iPads, and it's edging up on 2 million iPhone 4s. But it was the sale of good old Mac computers that took analysts like Gartner's Mike McGuire by surprise.
In the hullabaloo and all the news about the iPad in the last quarter, and then the iPhone 4, and then everything after the iPhone 4 launched, people forget they still sell computers.
Some analysts also believe that the iPad, which lets users surf the web, read email and books, and do other tasks, might have slowed the sale of Apple computers. But that clearly wasn't the case. The company sold 3.5 million computers, up about a third over last year. Looking ahead, analyst McGuire wonders if bad press about reception problems with the iPhone 4 will hurt sales as it launches in other markets around the world.
Will everybody in the other markets be as focused on the last month as we in the U.S. have been?
During a conference call, COO Tim Cook didn't seem to think that the bad press was hurting sales in the U.S. Cook says that iPhone 4s are flying off the shelves as fast as Apple can make them. Cook also emphasized that the company had not made too few of the phones on purpose to create a shortage just to get buzz. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
And in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, a new reality show is on the hunt, not for the next best singer or the best dancer or the best husband, but for the ideal imam.
The search begins, and 10 of the best candidates have been chosen.
Memperkenalkan 10 calon imam muda Anda.
The TV show is called Imam Muda, or Young Imam, and next Friday the show's MC will pick the winner. Reporter Jennifer Pack of the BBC has reported on this, and she joins us now. And first of all, Jennifer, tell us, what will the winner get?
The winner gets a scholarship to study in Saudi Arabia, a car, a laptop, but the grand prize is a job will be waiting for them. They will become an imam at the end of their studies at one of the main mosques in Kuala Lumpur when they return.
And who are these contestants?
These contestants are all under the age of 28, and they come from a wide variety of backgrounds. Among them, there was a farmer, an engineer, and a bank officer.
And the channel that's doing this is a religious channel in Malaysia.
It's a Muslim lifestyle channel that is promoting all sorts of these types of programs. But this is one of the first of its kind in the country, because while there have been reality searches for the best Quran reciter, you know, the best singer, these do not hold a candle to what they're trying to achieve with this show, because this person is actually going to become a very important Muslim figure in the community. You know, some people might question that perhaps this is not the best way to look for a religious leader, but the show creators think that this is the best way to attract more young people to learn something about Islam and perhaps, you know, attract more of them to come to the mosque.
Now, when you say it's argued whether this is the best way to select a religious leader, it's not the audience that's going to select. It's not like American Idol or a program like that.
That's right. It's not a popularity contest. And this is the way that the show is hoping to maintain the integrity of religion, if you will. Only the Islamic scholar, he's the only one who can decide who stays and who goes. And so they're looking at whether this potential aspiring imam knows enough about Islamic theory. But on the other hand, aside from that, whether they can really relate to young people and their problems. You know, for example, if you hear someone in the community is perhaps thinking about divorce, relationships. They want this potential imam to go in and counsel this couple right away, you know, rather than hanging back until this couple approaches them.
Well, I've watched a bit of this, and in addition to the scholar, the MC questioning the contestants, I've also seen them visit an orphanage and try out their skills at sermonizing or reading prayers. What are some other things they've actually been seen doing in the program?
Some of the other challenges include counseling unwed pregnant teens, as well as talking to people who have joined motorcycle gangs, Mat Rumput, which is a big problem in Malaysia as well. One of the weeks that I went to talk to them, they were showing, the contestants showing up at a halal slaughterhouse to see if the chickens were being, you know, killed according to Muslim law. Usually the decision of who becomes an imam takes place behind closed doors at the religious affairs department or even inside the mosque. So this is a great insight to some people. And I've spoken to some fans who are, you know, well into their 40s and 50s, and they like the show because they think it's refreshing. Sometimes it even helps refresh their Islamic knowledge.
Well, Jennifer Pack, thank you very much for talking with us about it.
Thank you very much.
So Jennifer Pack, who is the Malaysia, the Kuala Lumpur reporter for the BBC, talking about the reality show Young Imam, or Imam Muda. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. President Obama signed into law today a new set of rules for the financial industry. They include what the president called the strongest consumer protections in history. The new law is the most sweeping overhaul of Wall Street in more than 70 years. But as NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports, it's also just the latest in a series of big legislative victories for Mr. Obama that have yet to pay off politically.
At the ceremony today, the president recalled how just 2 years ago the country was plunged into the worst recession since the Great Depression, and the primary cause was a breakdown in the financial system.
Unscrupulous lenders locked consumers into complex loans with hidden costs. Firms like AIG placed massive, risky bets with borrowed money. And while the rules left abuse and excess unchecked, they also left taxpayers on the hook if a big bank or financial institution ever failed.
The new law, the president said, would fix that problem, demanding accountability from bankers, borrowers, and consumers.
And unless your business model depends on cutting corners or bilking your customers, you've got nothing to fear from reform.
And the president promised that the most unpopular element in the government's response to the 2008 crisis would never happen again.
There will be no more tax-funded bailouts, period.
The signing had all the usual pomp and ceremony, beaming lawmakers, a few civilians on stage as proof the bill would help ordinary Americans. But there was something almost anticlimactic about the event, maybe because it had taken so long to pass, and because in the end the bill got far less bipartisan support than was originally expected, as the president acknowledged today.
And I also want to thank the three Republican senators who put partisanship aside, judged this bill on the merits, and voted for reform.
The law the president signed today is just the latest in a series of big, consequential pieces of legislation Mr. Obama has passed with great difficulty through a deeply divided Congress. First the stimulus bill, then health care, and now new rules for Wall Street. But all these accomplishments do not appear to be making the president or his party more popular. As Mr. Obama signed the Wall Street bill today, a new Quinnipiac poll was released showing his approval rating dropping to 44%. And perhaps more ominously, 37% said they would vote for an unnamed Republican in 2012. Only 27% said they would vote to reelect the president. White House aides like Press Secretary Robert Gibbs seem resigned to the fact that they won't get much credit until their biggest problem, the poor economy, begins to change.
If your neighbor lost their house, and if you'd lost your job, and a pollster called you and said, "How do you feel about the president?" I don't think that it's a wild-eyed stretch to believe that you would think things still need to get better in this country.
The signing took place at the Ronald Reagan Building, just a few short blocks from the White House. The venue was symbolic. Mr. Obama has talked about Ronald Reagan as the kind of transformational president he himself hopes to be. But White House aides are also increasingly looking to Reagan as a political model for how an unpopular president with a bad economy can minimize his party's losses in his first midterm election. Although back in 1982, the 26 House seats the Republicans lost were considered devastating to Reagan, he went on to win re-election easily, a feat the Obama White House would be happy to duplicate. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.